Good morning and happy Sabbath, Wantirna Church. How are we feeling today? All feeling good? I have to send some, apologies from the Brunt family. We made it 2 weeks without sickness, which was great. That was something. Thank you, Tim. You can sit down now, buddy. So my wife and my kids are watching online, and they would have absolutely loved that children's story, Evan. That was such a good job. Awesome work, mate. But also Pastor Daniel as well is down right now, so he's watching online. So we say hello to you guys. It's great to see those who have been able to come, though. We know sickness has affected a lot of people in this church over the past few weeks. And so if you are watching online, we are thinking and praying for you. Talking about illnesses, though, there is a certain person here who only a few weeks ago had heart surgery and is now sitting in the pews out the back. And by the way, this is Jeff Dever, by the way, right at the back. He turned up to table tennis on Tuesday and had a few hits too. So well and truly a miracle in the making in terms of his recovery. But here's the thing. Both Jeff and Cheryl just celebrated their 70th birthday yesterday and the day before. So let's give them a round of applause. They've done well. And when you see them, give them a big hug. Congratulate them. I have a sermon today that is the continuation of the series, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament. And it is a very weird sermon. So I'm just warning you now that this is a sermon that I bet you've probably never heard before. So, exciting? Yes. Scary? Yes. And I am excited to be able to share this with you. If anyone at the end of the sermon comes up to me and says, I've heard a sermon on that particular person, please tell me because I would be very interested. But to catch you up, because we are in a series, just to kind of, bring you to where we are so far very quickly. Number one, we talked about Jesus in the Old Testament, that he actually is there physically. Number two, we talked about being carried through the lineage and the promise from the beginning, the first prophecy that happened way back in the Garden of Eden. Number two, we talked about angelophanies and Christophanies. Does everyone remember what those mean? Angels and Christ appearing and coming to us in person in the Old Testament. Number four, we talked about Tamar and a few other women in Christ's lineage. And then last week, Daniel talked about Christ as Father. Today, we will be talking about Christ in the footnotes. Stories that you may not have heard before, people who have been slightly forgotten over time, who aren't the bigwigs. And I want to start off with a story that happened about 100 years ago. I'm going to put a picture up of someone, and let's see if you know who that person is. Does anyone know who that woman is? I'll give you a clue. It's about 1930s, 1940s, and 50s where she was quite popular. Hedy Lamarr. Who said that? Rick, well done. You revealed your age too, by the way, mate. That was a trick. Hedy Lamarr, yes. So, if you've heard about the story of Hedy Lamarr, she was an Austrian-American actress, and she was well known for a lot of roles back then. She was always cast as the femme fatale. You know, the woman who had the beautiful looks, as you can see, she was quite a beautiful woman. Anyone seen Samson and Delilah? That's what movie she was in. That's what she was famous for. And that was in about, I think, the 1940s, late 1940s. But it wasn't her acting that actually was her greatest claim to fame or achievement, but her contributions to an invention that we all use today. Now, I bet you wouldn't connect an actress 100 years ago to an invention that we use, even right now, you were probably using. During World War II, Hedy Lamarr became concerned about the dangers that faced the Allied ships. Radio-guided torpedoes were often jammed by the enemy, making them unreliable. So, she asked a simple question. What if a radio signal could jump between different sources and have multiple frequencies at once, making it impossible to block? Great idea. So she teamed up with a composer and his name was George Antheil, and together they invented a frequency hopping system. Now, here's the interesting thing. At the time, the Navy dismissed the idea. Maybe for many reasons. Maybe because it was an actress and a composer coming up with things that they thought would be used in the military. Who knows? But the idea was tucked away, pushed away in the dark, and was never used, forgotten. And Hetty died not knowing that her invention would be used for something important. It wasn't until 50 years later that you may know this organization, the CSIRO, yep, Australian organization, by the way, teamed up and they invented something called Wi-Fi. If you have a phone in your pocket, if you've ever used a computer, if you've got a little big black box in your house that connects to the NBN, then you are using an invention that started by a woman called Hedy Lamarr. And I bet you didn't even know that. Now, here's the thing. She didn't know that her invention would be so integral to the technology that we use today, and she has been very much forgotten. A lot of people don't even know that Wi-Fi was an Australian invention. All right? And so these are really great stories. I wanted to share the story because it gives us a launching pad to what we're going to experience in the Bible. We're going to look at a few people and specifically one person who has almost been forgotten in time but is integral to the Bible and Christ's mission. So as we do that, I want you to... Let's not go into the Bible yet because I want to maybe set the scene biblically. Here is a picture of people that you probably do know in the Bible. You've obviously got the one right in the front with the Ten Commandments. That's Moses. You've got people like Abraham. You've got Joseph. You've got David, Daniel, all of these people who are very much important. And what they are called, they're called types of Christ. What is a type? A type is a person that is like someone. And so all of these great people in the Old Testament are pointing towards something greater, pointing towards Jesus, kind of like a reflection in the mirror or a shadow. It's you, but it's not quite you. They just have similar attributes. Now, there are many types in the Bible that I could have chosen for the sermon. We've got Abraham, who is the father of many nations. That's an obvious one. I could have chosen Daniel, who was faithful right to the end. Even in the lion's den, he was faithful to his morals and his beliefs. What about David, who is the king of Jerusalem and the anointed one, which in Hebrew means Messiah? We've got all of these types. I mean, it was so hard for me not to preach on Joseph today. Because Joseph is the quintessential type of Jesus. Everything that he did pointed towards Christ. I mean, I'll just give you a little bit of what Joseph's story points towards Christ. And you'll be like, yep, you should have preached that one, Dan. We've got this idea of betrayed by his own people to die. He went from the lowest to the right-hand side of the king. He becomes the savior of his people. He stayed true to his convictions, even through temptation. We could go on and on and on. Jesus, 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 Jesus. But I'm not doing that today. Because the title of the sermon is Christ, not in the headlines, but in the footnotes. I wanted to give you something that is slightly different than normal. And so today is dedicated to the unknown ones in the Old Testament. Let me give you a few. These are pictures, by the way, if you're very cluey, who do you think I asked to make this picture? Yeah, I'm sorry, it's ChatGPT. I know, we won't even get to that. But if you have a look, you might be able to spot some. Does anyone know who Phineas is? Ever heard of a guy called Phineas? Very, very important person. He was a priest that actually stopped God's punishment temporarily, which was quite an achievement. Anyone know a guy called Ehud? I want you to put your hand up if you're left-handed. Do we have no left-handed? Oh, no, we do. We've got a few. Yes, great. So Ehud should be your man. Ehud was famous for being left-handed. And he did so in a way, he was a judge that delivered Israel in a very unlikely way. Does anyone know the story of Balaam's donkey? I always think of Shrek every time we hear that. I just see his Eddie Murphy's voice when it comes out, you know, when I'm reading that story. But Balaam's donkey is really important. It's a really good story and yet not really big in our teachings. How about Uriah the Hittite? Do you know who he is? is actually one of my favorite characters in the Bible. Loyal, even unto death. Now, all these people can be counted under the Hedy Lamarr category. People who are integral, but almost forgotten. And they shaped the Bible and the story towards Christ. But there is one person that I've chosen to focus on today. And 10 points. No, I'll give you 100 points if you can guess who I'm going to focus on today. No, not you, Tim. You already know. Put your hand up if you know Melchizedek. Okay, few hands. Great. Could I safely say that the most you probably know about Melchizedek was that he was a king and a priest? Yeah? That's mostly people's knowledge about Melchizedek. I'm going to do a sermon around a guy that the Bible only uses 3 verses to talk about, right? And this is going to be interesting. In fact, there are 4 parts of the Bible where he's mentioned, but only 3 verses where his story is actually told. And so while we look at the story of Melchizedek, and there are the verses there, Genesis 14, Psalms 110, Hebrews 5, and Hebrews 7, I want you to make your way to the book of Genesis right now. So grab your Bibles. We'll be starting in Genesis 14. If there's anyone here who wants a Bible, we have some in the walls there. In the nooks, we have some Bibles. I will also have it on the screen, but as much as I try to advocate for your own Bibles, please use your own if you have it. Genesis 14, and we'll be looking at those 3 verses, 18 to 20. This is literally the only 3 verses we have about the narrative of Melchizedek's story. Genesis 14, verses 18 to 20 starts off like this. And Melchizedek, the king of Salem, and a priest of God Most High, brought Abraham some bread and wine. Melchizedek blessed Abraham with this blessing. Blessed be Abraham by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has defeated your enemies for you. Then Abraham gave Melchizedek a tenth of all the goods he had recovered. That's the story of Melchizedek. There's not much there, is there? And when we read that, it's interesting in context, because if you're reading the chapter of Genesis 14 and you're reading the other verses and then Melchizedek's story almost comes in very randomly, it almost comes in almost angelic-like, where there's this narrative and then Melchizedek inserts himself into the narrative and then it carries on. In fact, I want to show you this. Look at verse 17, the verse just before 18. And then I want you to look at verse 21, which is the verse after the story of Melchizedek. So 17 and 21. And I want you to see if the narrative works like that. Verse 17 says this, "And after Abram returned from his victory over Kedorlaomer and all his allies, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Sheveh," that is the king's valley. Skip down to verse 21. "The king of Sodom said to Abram, 'Give back my people who were captured, but you may keep for yourself all the goods you have recovered.'" I don't know if you noticed this, but the narrative continues almost seamlessly. He's talking to the king of Sodom, and then he continues talking to the king of Sodom. So why is the story of Melchizedek almost forced into the narrative? When you read it, it's actually quite jarring. It doesn't actually make much sense. And you think, why on earth is Melchizedek in the story? What has he got to do with what's happening? If you know what happened, Abraham just rescued Lot. And so all these kings were coming to fight in this place. And after Abraham and his people had won against the kings, we have the story of Melchizedek. Now, I hope that this almost perks your interest, because the story of Tamar was exactly the same thing. Do you remember? When we were looking at Genesis 38, and then I got you to read the end of 37 and the start of 39, they were the same story. It was Joseph and his brothers were sent into captivity, and then the start of 39, Joseph went into Egypt as a captured person. So we have these stories that are almost inserted, and it's almost as if the Bible is telling us, when you're reading this, this is important. There is a reason to this. Have you ever played hide and seek as a kid? Anyone do that? I'm sure you all did, right? Now, I was never good at hide and seek because I'm a big guy and I always have been. So finding places for me to hide was really hard. Someone who's really good at hide and seek is my daughter, Naomi. She is brilliant at it because, and I've noticed this with her, when she finds a place, she not only hides in that place, but she moves all the things around the environment to make it look like no one's been there. So that's the problem about those who are bad at hide and seek. There's always something around them that looks off. Maybe the carpet's been moved a little bit, or there's something that just was not in the same place it was before, and that's how you catch them. Naomi is so good at making the environment look so natural. And it takes us sometimes a long time to find her, and we don't have a very big house. So she does it very, very well. If you've ever played a game, especially the modern games, one of the things that you know as a gamer is that if something looks off while you're playing the game, it usually means there's something valuable here. There's probably a door that needs to go in, or a bookcase that needs to be moved because there's something behind it. Right? That's the same thing with the Bible. When we look at the Bible and we find something off, we stop, we look, because there's something important here. And Melchizedek is showing us that there is something here to look at. So what do we have after these three verses? What information do we have? Because it's not a very big narrative. Well, we know his name is Melchizedek. And if you know what that means, literally, it means king of righteousness. He's also the king of Salem. Salem means peace. Now, here's something. When you hear the word Salem, does anyone else hear something else? Jerusalem. They're the same place. So the old way of talking about Jerusalem was Salem, and then it was Jerusalem. He's a priest and a king. He met Abraham after the defeat of multiple kings. Here's an interesting one. He brings bread and wine. That's odd. He blesses Abraham. Abraham gives him a tithe. By the way, first time tithe is mentioned in the Bible. And then he leaves. And that's the story of Melchizedek. Now, we can already see that he's a type of Christ by just looking at these three verses. I mean, if I go through that list, who is the king of Jerusalem? Jesus. Who is the king of righteousness and peace? Jesus. Who is also a priest and a king? Jesus. Who brings bread and wine? Jesus. Who blessed Abraham? And I want you to remember this. Who did it? Jesus. This is clearly pointing towards Christ. And hopefully I've trained you to ask this question when you see characters in the Old Testament like this. Is this actually Christ? Is this a Christophany? You know how we're talking about the angel of the Lord, and he would present himself as an angel, but really it was God. Do you remember this? So is Melchizedek Christ? What do you think? Or is he a type of Christ? Now, there are three schools of thought. I'm glad that you all look confused, because this is really, really good. There are three schools of thought as to who Melchizedek is. Number one, it's a Christophany. It's actually Jesus incarnate. There's a second school of thought, which is that it is a typology of Christ, which is someone pointing towards him. And there's a third school of thought, which is really out like left field, which is this is one of Noah's sons, Shem. Now, there's a big reason for that one, and it's probably the least likely. It's actually based on a lot of Jewish traditions like the Targum and the Midrash. But even in their traditions, they have disagreement. So for me, as a pastor, I would safely say that he probably isn't Shem because it doesn't have much biblical evidence. So we're kind of left with the question, is this a person or is this a Christophany? And I hope you remember what the code was to kind of apply to this. I'll remind you again what the code was. Number one, do they receive worship? Do they claim to be God? And do they have an authority unto themselves? So let's just go through them one by one. Does Melchizedek ever ask for worship? No. Does he ever claim to be God? No. Does he speak on behalf of someone higher than him? No, he just speaks on behalf of Melchizedek. So we can safely say, XXX, that he probably isn't a Christophany. This is not one of the ones that we've talked about in the past. This is probably a type, one who embodies Christ's attributes. But let's not put the cart before the horse because we haven't read all the verses yet. We've only read one. So let's go to Psalms 110, verse 4. Psalms 110, verse 4. It's a very short verse, so I'll happily read it from the front. It says, "The Lord has taken an oath and will not break his vow. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." This is a messianic prophecy on behalf of King David. King David is in charge of chapter 110, and he's saying that the Messiah will be a part of the order of Melchizedek. And what on earth does that even mean? Here's the interesting thing. King David is writing this during the time where the Levitical priesthood is well and truly working and doing well. It was at its height. He had his own priests that were Levitical priests. And if you don't know the culture back then, if you wanted to be a priest, you had to come from the line and the tribe of Levi. If you were born in any of the other 11 tribes, sorry, mate, you cannot be a priest. You're not a part of the tribe and the lineage of Levi. But what's interesting here is David is saying that there is this unknown Messiah that we're all waiting for, and he will not come from this line, from the Levite line, but he will still be a priest. Now, we don't know how that worked. If you were in that context in that time, it would have made zero sense. And again, this pattern of randomness kind of follows through. It's a random verse in Psalm 110, and then poof, nothing more about Melchizedek. In fact, these are the only two things in the Old Testament about Melchizedek, and then nothing for 1,000 years. For 1,000 years, there's silence and there's mystery. And I want you to notice something, that if we did not have the context of the New Testament, then Melchizedek would have zero, it wouldn't make any sense. There'd be no context. Having just those three verses plus the verse in Psalms, you go, what on earth does Melchizedek have to do with anything? Just a random guy that kind of just popped in and popped out. We need that context. Have you ever been in a conversation where you've walked in halfway through and you don't have the context as to what's going on? I do this a lot. I kind of come in, try to be friendly, see what the group is talking about, and I have no idea what's going on, so I just stand there blind for the next 2 minutes trying to figure out what they're talking about so I can at least join them at their level. I remember one time when I did this, and this was many, many years ago, I walked into these two ladies who were talking, and the first thing that I heard was, "And she kidnapped them and locked them in a closet, and now I don't know what to do." And I thought, what on earth is going on? I've obviously walked into something illegal and I should not be here. And they carried on and they said, "And I don't know who to tell. My brother tells me that if I told anyone, they would get angry if I got them involved." And I just didn't know what to do. I wasn't a pastor back then, so I didn't have the mandatory, you know, legal requirement of telling people they have to go to the cops. And so I just was trying to kind of, you know, slump away from the conversation to make sure I wasn't a part of the accessory to the, whatever this is. And the lady saw me and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you probably don't understand what's going on. I'm talking about the TV show that I'm watching." And I thought, ah, that makes a lot of sense. And she was scared to tell anyone because the episode had just come out and she was worried that if people knew what had happened, that people would get angry. Ah, makes sense now with context. But what we're doing is we're walking into this conversation about Melchizedek without context. And so all we can see is what's in front of us until we have the book of Hebrews. And the book of Hebrews gives us that context. And so I invite you all, go to the book of Hebrews right now in the New Testament. I want to hear those pages turn. Hebrews chapter 7 is where we're going to be. So put your finger there. And while you're going there, I also just want to tell you as well, the book of Hebrews in itself is shrouded in mystery. Did you know that we don't actually know who the author of Hebrews is? There is contention. We think it might be Paul. but it's not really in his literary way of speaking, and so we're kind of just all over the place here. So even the story of Melchizedek is still shrouded in a book of mystery. But let's have a look. So we'll look at the first three verses of Hebrews chapter 7. Hopefully this will give us a bit of context. Starting in verse 1. This Melchizedek was king of the city of Salem and also a priest of God Most High. When Abraham was returning home after winning a great battle against the kings, Melchizedek met him and blessed him. Then Abraham took a tenth of all he had captured in battle and gave it to Melchizedek. The name Melchizedek means king of justice, and king of Salem means king of peace. We know all this. Here's the next part. There is no record of his father or mother or any of his ancestors, no beginning or end to his life. He remains a priest forever, resembling the Son of God. Now, does that kind of sound like to you that maybe this could be Christ? He has no beginning or end. He's a priest forever. He's like the Son of God. That's a lot of language that kind of assumes maybe this is Christ. I wanted to show you these verses because when we read this, our little ears kind of pop up and we go, hang on a minute, something's going on. Until you actually go back and you read that it's being very literal. It says there is no record of his father or mother or any of his ancestors. Hebrews is actually telling us right in front of us what's going on. If you were a Jew and you had no record of your mother or your father or your lineage, guess who you are according to the Jews? You're a nobody. You've got nothing. You don't come from anything. Whenever the Jews would introduce themselves, that would be, my name is Dan of, and then you'd say what your family's from. That's how you would introduce yourself. Your family was everything. Your lineage was everything. And so here, we've got the author of Hebrews showing us that because we don't know who Melchizedek was, he has no lineage, he has no beginning or end, then technically, his priesthood never started and never ended. Can you see what I'm saying? It was a forever priesthood. And so, in essence, his priesthood has never stopped, very much like Christ. Now, you might have gotten to the point where you say, but Pastor Dan, what has this got to do with me in 2026? We've been talking about this historical figure. We've been talking about all this stuff. What has this got to do with me? Well, lots. And I'm going to try my best in the very little time I have to explain why. You need to think like a Jew when we are looking at things like this. The book of Hebrews was written to a group of Jews who were converting to Christianity. And during that time, there was this debate as to what things from the Jewish customs were going to move into this new faith of Christianity. And they had a tussle about this. They didn't know what they had to bring from the old and bring to the new. Now, we would have the same problem. Is anyone here someone who hasn't been born in Australia that traveled to Australia as an immigrant? With any of them here? Great. Now, here's the thing. How much of your culture did you bring to Australia? A lot or a little? A lot, right? Hopefully. I feel really sad when people lose their language. You know, if there's someone who speaks another language and they haven't taught their kids, it makes me really sad, probably because that's what happened to me. I really wanted to know Tagalog from Filipino. But anyway, I'll talk to mom next week and we'll figure it out. But the idea of the culture coming across is so natural to us, right? And we do it so naturally because you want to bring those traditions in. I remember me, even from New Zealand to Australia, the customs are very similar. But I can't get over my Marmite sandwiches, right? I hate Vegemite. I cannot do it. And I know that the tastes are very similar, and Vegemite is a lot cheaper, by the way. Marmite is very expensive, but I've got to have my Marmite. That's just something that I've brought over from New Zealand. And so when you travel, when you move, when you go to different places, this assimilation process has to happen. And I've got something here in my notes to say, is there anyone that travels to like Asian countries or maybe Middle Eastern countries and they have to have cereal for breakfast, right? And have you ever noticed if you walk into a store and look for cereal, they look at you funny because no one eats cereal for breakfast? It's weird. They have bread and they have, you know, the normal food for breakfast. But for us, where's my cereal, right? Because it's so normal for us. The Jews had a very rigid tradition. And so it was a big ask for them to come across to what they called the new covenant, the changing of the guard, per se. This whole ceremonial law that they had been brought up with for 1,400 years, by the way, that they had been under. And suddenly, this man called Jesus upends it all and says, no, you don't need to carry that across. But the Jews were struggling with this transfer. They had sacrifices, they had offerings, feasts, festivals, laws, holidays. All of these things were all central to who they were and their identity. And what made it even more central was the Levitical priesthood. It was all centered around this priesthood. And so the reason why I bring this up is because when we get to Hebrews chapter 7, the first six chapters of Hebrews is trying to build this context. You can have a read when you get home. The author of Hebrews is trying to convince the Jews who have become Christians to let go of the old and to come across. And it uses language like, Jesus is now your high priest. No longer do you have to go with the high priest of the Levites because Jesus is now the high priest. But by the time we get to chapter 7, he brings in the big guns because it's not working very well. And he mentions someone that hasn't been mentioned for 1,000 years. Have a look at verse 11. We're in chapter 7, verse 11. This is kind of the crux of the sermon today. So if the priesthood of Levi, on which the law was based, could have achieved the perfection God intended, why did God need to establish a different priesthood with a priest in the order of Melchizedek instead of the order of Levi and Aaron? Why did Melchizedek even have to exist? This verse tells us the reason. Because there will be no need for Melchizedek and his story and his lineage to even be real if the lineage of Levi and the priesthood and the ceremonial law worked. But it never did. It was a failure. The rules and the regulations and the law, God knew from the beginning that it would never, ever work. And here's the kicker. Where was Melchizedek's story in the timeline compared to when the Levitical law was placed? You may not know this, but it was around about 1400 BC when the Levitical law and all the setup of the tribes and the customs and the festivals and the beliefs, all of that was established. The story of Melchizedek happened around 2000 BC, which means God set up the story of Melchizedek 600 years before the line of Levi was actually established, which means for 600 years, God knew that that would fail. He knew that the laws and the customs and the sacrifices that the Jews did every day, twice a day, would eventually fail. And so what is so amazing about this is that it tells us that Christ did not come because humanity failed. He came already knowing we would fail. The idea of Christ was never plan B. There was this idea that when we read the Bible and we go and we look at how the Jews did their thing in the Old Testament, it's almost as if all of the hopes all were on their shoulders. And we're all watching them to see whether they will pass. And we know, if you've read the Old Testament, that the Jews failed completely. They couldn't do it on their own. But God already knew that before it was even put in place. Christ was always plan A. And by the story of Melchizedek, we actually understand that in context because you clearly see with the mysteriousness of whether is that Christ or is that just a person in Melchizedek. The reason why he is so closely connected to Christ is because the Bible wants us to know that there is no doubt that God had a plan in action before the Levites were even a thing, before the Jews were even a thing, by the way. God had this world under control. And so when you have a look at the attributes of Melchizedek, being king of righteousness, king of Jerusalem, king of peace, a priest and a king. He met Abraham at the defeat of multiple kings. He brings bread and wine. He blesses Abraham. Abraham gives him a tenth to him, and then he leaves. It actually all makes sense in context. This was a prophecy of Christ before the Jews were even a thing. Before all of the ceremonial law, which would not work, and that the only way to salvation was through Jesus. Melchizedek is the gospel message before we knew what a gospel was. And this is why it's so important for us to know this story. Hebrews 7 verses 15 to 17 continues. And it says, "This change has been made very clear since a different priest who was like Melchizedek has appeared. Jesus became a priest, not by meeting the physical requirement of belonging to the tribe of Levi, but by the power of a life that cannot be destroyed." And the psalmist pointed this out when he prophesied, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." Melchizedek, in the three verses that we have in Genesis, becomes the ultimate bridge between the Old Testament and the New Testament. He actually connects Jesus to the priestly lineage that is not imperfect. If the Jews saw that Jesus came from the line of Levi and was a priest because he came from that tribe, Jesus would be ineligible to become Messiah because he had to come from the line of, anyone know? Judah. And Judah was not a priestly line. But also, if he was connected to the Levite line, he would be connected to an imperfect system. But being connected to Melchizedek connects him to a perfect system that never ends. Isn't that powerful? And this story allowed the Jews to actually accept their fate and to say that we need to come across to this new covenant, this new gospel of Jesus, rather than falling on the works-based religion of the ceremonies and the law. Without the story of Melchizedek and his connection to Christ, we may not have had an influx of Jews come across to the Christian faith in the early times. That's how powerful this story is. It helped the Jews connect something that was theirs and be able to know that it was part of God's plan. And so let's look at how Hebrews 7 ends, and then we'll be almost done. Verse 26 to 28 says this, "He is the kind of high priest we need because he is holy and blameless, unstained by sin. He has been set apart from sinners and has been given the highest place of honor in heaven. Unlike those other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices each day. They did this for their own sins first and then for the sins of his people. But Jesus did this once for all when he offered himself as a sacrifice for his people's sins." Amen, church? "The law appointed high priests who were limited by human weakness. But after the law was given, God appointed his son with an oath, and his son has been made the perfect high priest forever." Aren't you glad that you have a high priest that never dies? Imagine if you're in the Old Testament and you just got to know the high priest and then he just died for some reason. And then you had another one that had to come. Almost kind of like now with the church pastors, right? And they kind of just get moved on after how many years. You get to know them and then suddenly they just kind of moved on. That's really annoying. But when you have a high priest that is there forever, who is living now, that is right now atoning and working for your salvation, aren't you glad that you don't have to bring a sheep or some birds or a goat to the altar every time you look at someone lustfully? Or every time you do a sin, or you steal, or you lie, or you cheat? Aren't you glad that you don't have to do that? Because Jesus was the ultimate sacrifice. Aren't you glad that your salvation is not based on your works alone? Amen? Anyone here think that their works alone would get them into heaven? Raise your hand. No, don't. Because no one in this room could do that. There are faiths and religions that believe in that. We as Christians believe no one is perfect. Only God can use that sacrifice as being perfect. See, we don't understand the gravity of his connection. If Melchizedek's story was not there, we wouldn't really understand the gravity of the situation because we're not Jews. But Melchizedek's story becomes that crucial bridge transitioning us from works-based salvation to the new covenant under Christ. Melchizedek is the ultimate Hedy Lamarr, the unknown who played a pivotal role in shaping the future so that something greater could come. And I'm going to invite the worship team to come up as I finish with my last slide. And I want to encourage you all to see every story in the Bible as important, even if the story is only 3 verses long. Because you might be surprised that everything in the Bible is actually really important. And when you have time to actually look at how much it points towards Christ, you may be surprised every time you open the book. And so my prayer is that your story, if you feel like your story and your life is insignificant, if you think your role in this world is small and does not matter, then let me rebut that claim. And let me say that your life and story matters. You may even live and die and not know the effect of your faithfulness to God until we get to heaven. And so my prayer is that we all live a life of faithfulness. We may not realize the effect of our actions. We may not realize the importance of our faith in God. But trust me, the best thing that God can use is a vessel that wants to be used by Him. And so my prayer is that that will be you as it was for those unknown characters in the Bible. God bless you. Take care.